that, well, it's a pleasure to be here in London and at LSE. And I think this project which we are working on with the students and with Ricky and with Richard Rogers and with Catherine further, I think it will be something, I hope, of interest and of great importance in deciding about how the city grows, because I understand that, that you are going to continue to grow, and so in that sense, you are a little bit like a third world city in a very strong way, because up to now, it's only the third world cities that were growing at the speed. But anyway, tonight, I did speak on this subject on housing about a year ago when I was here at LSE, and tonight when I was asked to speak by Ricky, which I tried to talk, easy to show up again and speak again. I said, look, I'll just speak on my buildings. He warned me that many of you in the audience would not be architects and might be very bored by this, so if you are, just call out, go faster, just stop. But I thought it would be something which at least might interest the architects, in fact, because Grant is trying to tell you how to design it. I mean, everyone feels they can design a house, and they can. That's the irony of it. Oh, it's true. I think like the way I think Noam Chomsky says that we learn language because, not because of high IQ, but because we are wired, we are programmed to learn a language. I'm beginning to feel that human beings are programmed to build, like birds build nests. Every human being has that instinct. Any child, you give them blocks and you put one over the other. When we look at something like Mykonos, it's beautiful, not just because it's beautiful, but because it's coherent. But anyway, that's another subject altogether, but it tells you how fundamental is architecture. Now, anywhere you build in architecture, I mean, as an architect, certain issues come up. Can you hear me? Is this mic working? Okay. In that sense, the issues are different in different places. Architecture is not, for me at least, is not a movable feast. Rubinstein can play Chopin in the jungles of Brazil and the next night in Tokyo, etc. The same concert, and it's absolutely legitimate. He recreates a very precious thing. Architecture is rooted on the land, it's rooted in a climate, it's rooted in a culture, apart from an economy. And that's its strength. It's really a piece of, what's that called, site-specific art. It's what Richard Serra tries to do with the sculpture, that you cannot move it. The sun catches it in a certain way, etc. So each place where you're in, every architect practicing in a place comes across certain issues which come out of the architect himself, out of the clients and the projects he's working on, and out of the place itself. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about the issues that come out of working in India. Well, to begin with, I've just listed three or four, and they'll come up as we look at some slides. The first is climate. I'll just put it first, any of them could be first. Climate, because a building has to deal with the sun, with the rain, and especially in a society where you're not going to go in for mechanical engineering, the very shape of the building has to do that. The Alhambra, which many of you have seen, is very beautiful, but it's not an arbitrary piece of a stage set, no. It's a machine for dealing with the terrible desert, dry desert heat of Andalusia. You've got the high walls to cut out the desert air, winds. And then once the air is trapped, you've got the fountains to humidify the air and bring down the climate, the temperature. If I repeat the same thing in some five-star hotel, I'm making a mockery of that because it has no meaning, no raison d'etre. Whereas in the case of the Alhambra, it is the response to climate that triggered up the basic imagination. And that, of course, is lost as societies get richer and the architects get lazier and we start using the mechanical engineer to solve our problems, which was never true in the past. Another thing, of course, are the issues of economy. That when you're really very poor, it's amazing how you recycle things. And I don't think architects work for such situation, but certainly if you go to a village anywhere, and that's not just true in India, it's true in Southeast Asia and in the Pacific, you'll find the most beautiful villages, and they're just made from the leaves of the palm trees falling down and used again as roofing material, etc. Almost nothing leaves the village. So the true ecosystems come not from the rich, but really from necessity. In fact, quite often for us in India, it's very ironical. You see published a building which is a green building, tremendously efficient, and you look at it, and one element of it, just that tremendous, wonderful cast, something or the other piece, would use up more energy than the Kerala village uses in a year, just to mold it, to hard press it. So we must realize that it's finding necessity that makes us inventive. And in this, I'm saying it's not that the architect redo it, but India is full of such examples. I'll show you some, and it really knocks me out. First of all, it makes you realize that it makes you feel humble, but it also stimulates you to think how wonderful things can be when people use the ingenuity. And that, of course, gets you into issues of housing, issues of urbanization, which I'm not going to go into. I'll just touch on them since we are discussing them in class, and we did this last year. But the issues of urbanization are huge in India. Now, all these issues come to you as an architect way beyond what you expect you'd have to deal with. And it's not that you find the answers, but just in looking at those issues, you have a chance to grow. You have a chance to look at something bigger than yourself. I think that's the nicest thing I could say, hopefully, Ricky, about our studio here, is that those issues, even in these last 2 days, are epic. They're tremendous issues about everything, about not just costs and stuff, but about people's lifestyles and finally people's aspirations. That's really what determines what goes into the habitat. And lastly, of course, is culture. Well, there are many more issues than this. When my list came last, it's tremendously important. Now, culture just doesn't mean that the architect imitates the images from the past. I'm talking about a much deeper level than that. I think Louis Kahn, the great architect from America, Philadelphia, he was talking to some students. And he called that, this kind of deep structure which underlies culture, he called it volume zero. And the way he said it, remember, he said something like, I think he starts by saying, I love English history. I don't know why he chooses English history. He says, I love the bloody battles. You all have more bloody battles than anyone else anyway. He said, I love the bloody battles. And he said, I've got these 8 volumes of English history, and I love reading them. Then he says, I haven't read them all, actually. I've only read the first one. Then he says, I haven't even read the whole thing. I read the first few pages, and I stop. He said, because I don't think history started like that. I think history started before that. I want to read volume zero. And you look at the work of someone like Corbusier, who are right, and they seem to have intuitively understood, in Pope's case, what is volume zero in the Mediterranean world, and he could express it in concrete and glass. And Wright, of course, had a sense of what were the aspirations, and he invented the way Americans were going to live for 100 years, a brand new country, a brand new century. So, I'll now show you some pictures, and I think in that I'd like you to think of these issues and how they might apply to you here in England too, but we'll just look at them in the context of India. And don't forget, when we say talk about culture, it's not just copying the past or trying to evoke it, but trying to express in today's materials, with today's aspirations, something as constant as what we call culture. So we start. I think go to the beginning for you. It's way there.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ray, that's not the thing you started the first. It's more than an iconic image. I would call it an ideogram. It tells you something, whether sometimes it's a piece of architecture, but sometimes it's a collection of objects. And it tells you tremendously, not just about Gandhi, but about a value system which lies quite explicitly in India, the idea of renunciation. And I'm not trying for a second to say that Indians are materialistic. Believe me, they're as materialistic probably more than most people. But in the case of that space where the person who renounces all, whether it's Mother Teresa or Mahatma Gandhi, is respected and not seen to be a fool who didn't understand that he should hang on to it all. So Gandhi died and he leaves from the first to wear the glasses that was humanity. And that's his house, which is a guy with stone floors and brick walls. And I was quite young and asked, I just come back from studying, and I asked to design the memorial where they keep his letters and books and stuff. And I thought that I would like to do something with using the same material, but using it with our 20th century voice, and in a way which also which is expanded. That you can, if you get more books, you can add to them as well, that you can discover, etc. So we get really a very simple system of courtyards. But first of all, a roofing system which is tiled roof, the stone floor, and the brick walls. There are no windows, there's the louver, which lets the breeze through. But, much of the building is a kind of covered view where it becomes contemplative and you can dissipate. So it's not all enclosed spaces. The only element added, of course, is this concrete channel which allows the vent to extend the building and to get rid of the rain. So these kind of spaces which connect then the enclosed spaces were the essence of the room. Project. And it's much later on that I learned that, I did this intuitively, I just felt this is something one should do. We did it at a very small scale, of 20 feet by 7 feet high. So, because that was to give the scale of Gandhiji. The nice thing about it is that it allows people, we were quite humble people from a village, so they feel quite free to come in and look around. They don't feel intimidated by that. But this idea of moving through, of having open to sky space, is very, very important, I think, in India. And to me, it's part of volume zero in India. I'm showing you these two slides because it illustrates that. For instance, this is in a completely different climate. This is Chicago, this is IIT, this is the Illinois Institute of Technology, this is Lise van der Rohe's chapel. And you can see it's a box and it keeps the weather out. And it's very clear that there's a skin which is impermeable except at one point, which is the door. You cannot penetrate it. And you're either inside the box or outside. But here, back when I got back to India, and this is what I studied when I was in America, the early 50s. When we got back to India, we realized it's completely different, the instinct of people. Here, you can be inside or outside the structure in 20 different ways. What is important, of course, is that at no moment are you opening a door to go in. And that covers you when you're feeling up and getting under the shade of the structure. That's one set of things. The second set of things is that in the case of knees, he ends with a straight line. Whereas in the case of this architecture, so the cat keeps it aside. The sky is something which you must bring into the building. Those of you architects, I'm sure agree that Corbusier was an architect who caught the piece of the sky in darts and started both again, understanding how evocative that was. Now, I know there's a very good reason Nice didn't catch the piece of the sky. The Chicago sky is so cold, only a fool would catch it and bring it into the building. But I'm not criticizing this. I'm trying to say the volume zero for Chicago is different from the volume zero for India, certainly for Rajasthan. That's why architecture is not really such a movable thing. And from this then comes what is very, very deep, not just in India, but in Asia and Africa, to any of the warm countries, is the idea of, in this case, the guru sitting under the tree, is really enlightenment coming and liberation. This is in West Africa, center. Just a hard building, but the whole thing is structure. The architecture really is a key to create the whole space. So all this you slowly absorb into osmosis, and as you go to design, you begin to realize that, you know, that's much, much more effective than just making a facade. So I'll go very fast to this. This was actually the first building, which was at the same time started as the Gandhi Ashram, but was finished in 3 months. It was designed and built and moved it for an exhibition at Sabi and then to the World Fair and Filter. And we made these walls. And we go up and we go out and down. So this idea of moving is really receptive, people will understand. And then the roof was free of the wall, and it's just flat. And you get that gap in the sky. So this idea of moving through and around allows you then a complete, and using open space allows you a different kind of typology for museums. This was in 1961, I think. But yeah, this was in the same thing, but 3 years later. Here the site was a long one, and I decided to try and do this in concrete. We have quite a different form, but the principle is the same. You can see that they're going through in here, they're coming out from there. And like this. And if you can see, it will not have crossing in form like a simple building that's through the building. And the building itself was all folded concrete. Actually, I'd forgotten about this building. It was done in 1961, but a couple of years ago I was in Denmark, and the students had this on, I could give a talk, and they had put this on the poster. And I said, why? And they said, you know, this is so practical today. And Charlie Clenks was in Bombay about 2 months ago, and he said, you know, we should continue working in that direction. So I'm glad I did. What interested me about this wasn't because it was nice to do that, but I think what interested me was the idea of leaving it in a factor, which is another thing. Once you went through the building, the same kind of thing, and then you emerged from the top and go out. This was the pavilion for the Indian pavilion. And the thing of using all the surfaces and actually the what we call a production, a kind of ritualistic starting for the building grew in my mind. This was for Kasturba Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi's wife, and this is her samadhi. And again, it's in a park, and there are a few brick walls, but it makes you go around the movement of her field, but here too, where she was cemented, and that's a overlooking platform. So it's then there's a landscape around. This is an art center in Bhopal, which again, it's on the opposite base, you want to pick up, and you have this system of something called you're walking on the top of a public garden, which you can go down into the museum itself. Beautiful. Down here to the water. And you can see the system of courtyard. But now all this comes really, what you're looking at then is a view of a museum. Instead of being a completely sealed box like the Louvre, it actually is an open to sky space, and that used to clear the eye. And then if you see something, you might be going there, and again you're saturated with the objects you're looking at. They have many different collections in this museum, but the real experience is of course the movement too. And then finally it ends up on the way. It's actually extremely simple, and you can see it's both of them. It's just spotted in the field, it's just like this. This is the National Craft Museum in Delhi. Here the pathway is we have so many different kinds of wonderful crafts in India, and Vipul Jaika, who was in charge of it, he's the lady who organized the Festival of India here, you know, all the stuff that we have to do. She was really a wonderful woman. And she said that could it be that all the, should we organize it chronologically or by sections of the country or by materials like leatherwork or wood? And then she said actually the best structure would be village crafts, sacred crafts, and palace crafts. And all three are important, and all three are part of Indian heritage. And so we built this kind of very casual street, it's an open street, and from it are these caves, which are the, this is a room there. Here you keep walking down, this is the courtyard, you walk around the edge. And if you see something you like, you can go and see that section. Just like you would find in any Indian street, and the street is slowly changing from a village to become then a temple, a sacred area. So these are all real objects, these are from different temples and stuff. And then finally it becomes where the palace drops down. So the building you designed, you don't even see it, it's actually just it's just a movement pattern, and becomes like a collage. Now in such a situation, you can actually, of course, these are existing facades and palaces and stuff which are going to be knocked down to the quality and they reassembled. Veera Sarabhai, for people who come to India, has done a stunning job of this kind of thing much before I get this, from the Palace of Museum, which is one of the most beautiful museums of the world. Now this allows this craft museum, which is really a center for the craftsmen to come, because the craftsmen in India work in a very small box. They don't have the money to travel, and they're not like the modern painters in India who are all the time being invited to New York and stuff. And so it's wonderful for these people to get a kind of fellowship where they come and see some potter, they see pots made at the other end of the country, or maybe made in his part of the country or her part 300 years before. So, this is the kind of work they can do right there, and it will become a 3-month fellowship, etc. Now, I'm showing you these slides just to show you how wonderfully creative these people are, and how much they understand about how the eye works. And so, this again, I would say, was had a huge effect on me as an architect. You can't work in India. It's different being here, I think. There are other wonderful things one sees here. But the breadth of that craft you see in Mexico, of course, and you see in some countries, is something which affects the architect. Now, another thing which affects you, of course, as I mentioned earlier, is the inventiveness of people, of society, of the, what you might call the indigenous dreams of building. This is some housing Hyderabad Sindh in Pakistan, but we get it in Iran. These are wind catchers. The dry desert wind is caught at the trunk of grass and pulled down to the basement of the house where it goes into a room which has a water pool and gets to the temperature falls about 15 or 20 degrees and then it's circulated to the house. But look at the wonderful, the cockpit skyline this gives you. In fact, I think for GGA the best could not have done better. I think I hope Sandy agrees. It's an incredible thing that this has evolved slowly by people, by society. Tremendously, and whatever you saw, you see people living and look at so many other people. So this movement came from when I first started at home. And I won't go far, I go very fast to read because there's no point in trying to explain them all at the time. The architects might be interested. These are houses that Mr. Hathi arrived and goes out and draws new areas. But this is a very inexpensive, this is one of Ropa's house competition. This is the same thing, the same principle that applies to a big mill owner's house. And you can see it's a very new house, but it's got the same idea, the same principle that the Hathi arriving and the funnel and the horizontal. This was done in 16. And then of course the kind of funnel you get. It's light and sweet and sweet. I go back to the, this is all got to do with the use of the courtyard and then the roof. It protects it from the accident of the flue, so they can easily air out. And that gives you, this is an assumption, and that gives you really a section, which I call a summer section, which takes the hot air out. And then there's a winter section, which is the opposite, which is where you want the sunlight to come. This could be for afternoon section, this is the evening. This house is an underdark. And the two sections are put in a line like this so that the winter section is on the edge and then this pool is for all the services. And the winter section is the summer section in the center. And then this was applied also to an office building where we are trying to meet with us in Hyderabad, which was the one Sarabha, which was an office building which didn't have any air conditioning. But a microclimate was created. This again was done in the late mid-60s. At that time there was no air conditioning in India. Unfortunately now there are. We don't have prosperity, but we have something called what's it called, the market mechanism, which allows certain people to buy air conditioning and they turn out to be your planet. So you don't have to make this kind of effort, which is a change. But this thing was 2 inches of 3 inches of water on the roof. And that's enough really to reflect about 70% of the time. And then there's that center. Now here's another iconic picture, another ideogram picture. What we were looking at was trying to deal with a dry climate, hot dry climate like you get in Delhi and Ahmedabad. That's where the buildings are from. Now this comes from to Bombay or to South India where it's a hot humid climate. Now this is an old bungalow and it's wonderful, these bungalows. In fact, the British usually try to build a bungalow to live in. I don't think the bungalow came from India. I'm not a historian, but I don't think it did. But many people say it came from the word Bengali. It doesn't make any sense to me at all. Why should a Bengali have a name of a house? But I think it did come from Southeast Asia, where if you go even today to Malaysia, you see buildings which are separated. They don't form the kind of heavy, dense mass you get in North India, you get in Morocco, because it's a wet, humid region, you need the cross ventilation. But what they do, they keep an outside zone, what you call a veranda, which protects the more and more drugs coming from that, becomes living in a society where people are so degraded. And yet these are very hardworking people. They're not people who are going to mug you or something like that. But if you look at the planet, and this shows the number of jobs, and you can see why everyone wants to be at this end. So people who can't afford to live here, the middle class, they will come by train, the office workers. Just look at this platform. This station gets more than a million and a half people every morning. There's no place where you cannot touch the platform. And what's extraordinary is that people take it in their society. It doesn't lead to an immediate riot or some revolution or anything. People just accept that. But if you know something is very, very wrong when that happens. And you can see why that happened back when the originally Bombay was this size, and right after World War II it was about here, and then it started to be spread. And now the further spread to the first, more difficult to reach here. And so people then, so have a look at this. This is a bad view of the town. But it tells you that these are the high-rise buildings. And this is the other 50% that are running as a sea through these buildings, obstructed. And it's like people, there's such a discontinuity between the two sanctities. The people who can afford this kind of space, building, and then other people who can only afford this. So rather than just extending the building further, the city further and further north, what we did was, the three friends of mine, we started saying that we've got to open up more land. Open up more land means with the drugs. It's not a question of having people to move. And this is what New Bombay is about. And it's interesting because in a way the whole issue of parking, I think really in a way involves then where the drugs are. You know, if it is really going to open up land. In my case, I mean, living in Bombay, I find using, if you look at something about what the people earn, you'll find only about 40% are below the poverty line, but about 50% every year are the ones who live in squatters. Many of them are educated, they have very good jobs and stuff. You mustn't think that they're necessarily poor, they just don't have access to the kind of form that the cost of housing and what we call a pakka building. And so the buildings I showed you earlier on, many of them were designed just for the top 20%. Those are the people who can really afford brick and concrete and stuff. But this woman is doing also, she's sitting there using cooking in a space that is very cheap to build. It is beautifully decorated, etc. And so you begin to realize that using open space is a way to make affordable, at least for us in India, to make affordable housing. And I'll just tell you one project in New Bombay, which tries to, New Bombay is an area across the country, so we're telling about. In this case, we have taken about income profile of about 80% of the whole world, of the people. And we are trying to give each of them almost the same size piece of land, which goes from 45 to 70 meters. That's about 600 square feet. And seven of them are grouped around a little space of about 24 feet square. And this is a kind of semi-public, semi-private space for each family. And the houses don't touch each other, which is good in Bombay because we need free ventilation and also it allows each house to grow independently. You can see how it goes, you repeat that seven of them. This is just a way of generating high density but low-rise housing. This comes to about almost 100 units per You can see any given house, it can touch two boundaries, that's the plus. But if it's the front boundary, then you can have a window or a door. If it's the neighbor's boundary, then it can be a more solid wall because you need the privacy. But that doesn't matter, there's enough open space left to light your rooms, etc. And then the services are brought in, like a spider's thing. And then you can still even build it. But there's a great variety of housing possible, it's going all the way from exact, I mean, just a unity for squatters to try to distribute the power. And this is a whole scheme for 600. What you're looking at here is of course a central space, but you're looking at also the little spaces left over, which are disaggregated and which therefore makes the house very malleable. I think this is very important in housing, that there must be many, many ways that you can use the house. You can't just say this is low-income housing or this is whatever, low-income housing, so this is the house. There should be that flexibility. In fact, in doing that, I began to realize that what is far more important than what you're doing here is what you are leaving empty at the center. And from this came a whole series of ideas of how to make this was a think tank to Indira Gandhi, but she never built it. Because the idea was you have your state guest staying in one of our rooms as in this for. In the morning you get up and you come in the center and you discuss whatever world problems you want to discuss. This thing got built by, not by Indira Gandhi, but got built by someone in there, a friend of mine, and uses it as a think tank. And it's really very nice for the centrality. In fact, it was used in a movie called Monsoon Wedding, but they never really showed you a picture. But it was, you have a real discussion, you have this every 2 or 3 years here. And it's nothing here, but it's just the centrality of that. And then the four major directions are shown in the center. So looking at that, and that leads me to one last question. You can begin to see that again, a video there. There is something about this idea that the center is empty, which is very deep in Hinduism, which is very deep in Hinduism and Buddhism and Jainism. I think it occurs even in the Charabad of Islam. And the center is empty, so you get a mandala. This is a, you know, mandala, sacred diagram. And it's been used in India for building, but it was used also for the city of Jaipur, which you have seen already. The nine times, which is a mandala of the nine times. You can have 9 or 16 or 81 or 21. Most temples are 64, 81, but the 9 is actually at the 9th time. And then there was a hill, so this plan was moved over there, that planet, and that's how we got the plan of Jaipur. And this center is empty. So you see Jaipur is in the palace, to this area. These walls hold up the and then there's sometimes a hole in the wall and you can go through to another area. You can see that how this idea is brought in to create the whole city, the center of something, an invisible world, an unmanifest world. It's done by a man called Jaisin, the emperor. But he also was a person who had another set of mythic ideas in his head, and those are the newest myths of science. This is built by him. Many of you think you have probably seen these components, that they were instruments for measuring the actual position of the stars and the sun. So you really have two takes on the sky. One is the oldest myths of the mandala, the other the newest myths of science, of precision, etc. You can see the marvelous thing. The thing is held in a piece of marble. Cantilever away from steps on which the shadows fall are beautifully calibrated. So when we were asked to do this museum for Nehru, or I should say when we were making an exhibition on this Indian architecture, we used Jaipur, and I thought Jaisingh was the first modern Indian, because he was trying to rediscover the past, and also he wanted to make a brand new take on the style. I think Tantra Mantra was the first such instruments, except for the Indian day in Pakistan. It was really on the cutting edge of time. There was no equivalent to the world. And in that sense, I felt Nehru was the same, our first Prime Minister. He wanted to rediscover India and yet invent a brand new future. That's why he made Chandigarh. And I would imagine any new nation, I'm sure Mandela in South Africa, who has this idea of looking forward and backward, but not as schizophrenia, but in one gesture as in gentle. So I used the nine square and kept the center and we moved one square and built a different door. So it's about 3 entrances, to the library, to the administration, and to the theater. And then this is the staff and family, and then putting up the cards to you can see now that each of these squares is about 100 feet and each of them corresponds. I just took the program and broke it down into nine different components. They needed in the center, because they needed an amphitheater, so we left the twin in the center double as an amphitheater. Then this one is for this is Guru, this planet in this particular, which means teacher, so this is the library there. The nice thing, this was done, I thought, by the way, this is the spatial plan. You can see it's 100 feet and there's a 10 by 10 for the opening. So when you step through this box, you step into another world instead. And so it's a completely different set of kind of space because it's not based on the you can see the open space we were talking about earlier, the open to south space, and you can walk through this building without going indoors, but also you can do it by going indoors. And then these are the symbols of the nine planets. This is a beautiful drawing of 1920, the gouache of the planets, and kind of mythic color of those planets and the qualities of that. Each planet has its own quality. And there's some other kind of symbol that I'm trying to do. So, we just wanted to try and see how you could make a contemporary version of this. So a friend of mine is a very good graphic artist that was similar on this. He worked out what was the old traditional symbol. We decided to use only traditional symbols, but which spoke to us in a contemporary language. And then we worked out for each one, an internal space within the planet which expressed the quality of music. For instance, this is the empty one, Mangal, which means God, Jupiter, and you put the administrator there. This is the kind of painting you get in Rajasthan. That then to paint the dome of Mangal with the cosmograph, which is the giant idea of the non-manifest world. Which is, you know, every tree, every fish, and the center of God's energy. This is in another planet, this is the Krishna, and this is the Sitsvaran, sorry. Depending on the size of a person coming down. So these are all done by traditional things, but these are not the buildings which use contemporary painting. I like the relationship of painting and architecture. So this is another planet which is the moon, so this is supposed to be a pleasure, and it has to have the colors of the pigeon's feathers. And we put the restaurant there, and it costs 28 different. Have a completely different thing because this is the center which is empty. As you step through that, you will then step into this is the center thing. And as you step through that, just born here, that can be this world. You step into a completely different world. Is there a slide missing on the left? You get an idea of this stuff. And then the inside of the outside of the stone wall, the symbol of each planet, the inside has the specific color. This is the kind of inlay work you get in India by these people. And these are the gold symbols. This is the symbol of the moon, it's also the symbol of energy. This is the symbol of the depth of the sun, so it's the moon using the sun. It's a very old symbol. Imagine a bit of a sign before, but I like it because there was a game called Pac-Man, where the Pac-Man used to go around eating for a lot of that. And it's incredible, again, it tells you that the sophistication and the that's been constant. And this one is here. This is the inside of this planet. And that's the actual memory of the moon of the sun. These are the last two slides. This is the whole building. I like this slide because you know, this was because the idea of the sacred underline is very strong. Unfortunately, at the moment, it's leading to some, because of politicians, it's leading to a terrible kind of rioting, which is but in another way, it exists in people in a much gentler way, and it's part of their lives. So you go into your office and you see some little old lady sitting under the tree, little old woman, and with some powder, she's making some rangoli pattern, which is a model of the cosmos. And you don't pay any attention to her because you've got some phone calls to make or something. So when you are making a model of the product, you know, and that puts it all in proportion. Thank you very much. Have not come from villages. And the first thing we have to do is make conditions back in the village, if you really think about it. There's not a single political party in India today which talks about redistributing land, not even the communists. But 25 years ago, at least we should discuss that and implement it. So we are moving away from those solutions, unfortunately. But given the fact that people are coming and no one's going to do anything about making their lives better in the villages, I feel the changes, the interventions we make at the city level should be to increase the absorptive capacity of those cities. You know, Europe's grew double and triple in the 18th century, I think, the Italians, the Germans, the Irish, but the English too. But they could redistribute themselves around the world. And in the process, their standard of living went up and they had fewer children. So India could, and Chinese could redistribute themselves around the world, probably have another kind of answer. But until that can happen, it probably never will. Coming to Bombay is a substitute for going to Australia. I'm glad they have the energy to want to do that. If India was the kind of place where they lay down the villages and died, we'd really have a problem. One of the things that saved Europe was that when Europeans were poor and miserable and cold and all sorts of things, they had the energy to try and find new land and new sunlight. Right. So I celebrate the fact that migrants come to cities. And I think our problem is to intervene in our cities in a way which makes their life much better. We have poverty for another 25 years at least, but we don't need this degradation. I think that's what we're talking about. But I think I'd like to go back to your first question, which is a wonderful one, about the guru under the tree. You know, Tagore, whom you mentioned, the great poet, and he was more than a poet, I don't know how good his poetry was, and that's in the University of Bengali, I didn't say that, but he was a wonderfully creative man. I think, he used to dress in a maxi, and he used to dress, he invented his own dress, that he used to be in that kind of style, first 50 kind of thing. And he understood the aesthetic of the enunciation. I was reading somewhere about the Japanese art theory. There's something called wabi sabi or something. Wabi means humble, and sabi means getting older. And wabi goes something like this. I can see beauty in granite, and you can see beauty in mud. Your soul is finer than mine. And that's really beautiful. It tells you really why. Now, when he loved handloom in India, Gandhi, he did it for political reasons, not for aesthetic reasons. It is no longer politically correct or necessary. People have stopped wearing handloom. But Tagore understood the aesthetic and the metaphysical, and the other, the ethical basis of using the sitting under the tree. And of course, he understood too that under the open space, the mind opens. If the only way is anywhere in India, not just India, but just the whole of Asia, the Lord Buddha found enlightenment under the tree, not in a room like this. But these windows have, they make you feel almost out of noise. I'm saying this because it's shown that these windows are lit by fake light. But it's very effective with me, anyway. Put me back by the
You talked about briefly about the political responsibilities of an architect when you were answering this question. It was in 1985, I think, that you headed or you were part of the National Commission on Urbanization. And it's been 17 years since then. Neo-economic liberal restructuring process has thrown a lot of the roles and responsibilities of the various planning commissions in India into the shade. Your political role was very prominent when you served as a planning commissioner. In the new context, how can an architect take a political responsibility in the planning process? Can you briefly talk about what has happened in the last 17 years since the first commission on urbanization?
I think just to answer very briefly, we only get action if that the people in power are interested in doing something, whatever the issue is. I think India did a wonderful thing with our green revolution in terms of producing the food, at least. But that had tremendous political will. If we wanted to do the equivalent for cities, we could. That particular National Commission, of which I was the chairman, was appointed by Rajiv Gandhi. He was the first prime minister who was interested in cities. He really was. He was an urban animal, a young chap. And he said, please, you know, finish your report within a year at the most, because he said, I don't know what. At that time, he had some 70% of the vote. He was riding very high. And within a year or two, by the time he finished our report, Bofors had started, and then he couldn't do very much, and then he got killed anyway. But, and no government after that, not even any government, not even Narasimhan Rao's government, has been even slightly ambitious. That's what I find intriguing about London, that you do have a mayor, and who trusts someone, and who trusts Richard Rogers to advise him, and Ricky, and all that. That's remarkable. That hasn't happened in India. And it's a shame, because in the old days, in many of the states, for instance, in Mysore, you had very good planning, because of the Maharaja having a very good advisor, his Wazir kind of thing. Mirza Ismail. You know, it's very important to have somebody, the top person has to be interested in that subject. Now, maybe in a democracy like this here, where you have a great groundswell, I don't know, maybe people's opinions can work. But in India, it requires someone in the palace, someone at the top, has to be interested in that subject. Right now, they're unfortunately both, they don't make it political, but our leaders have another agenda altogether. It's got to do with religious warfare. It's just rubbish. And it's distracting everybody and preempting everything, instead of looking at real issues.
No, there is also the issue of the role, the personality, and the immodesty of the architect in this debate, which I think, certainly in this country, yes, one can point the finger at the past, at the political, lack of political leadership, and hope that maybe at this moment there is a bit more sort of aspiration. Not that much, by the way, don't get too positive. I think it's getting slightly better than it was maybe 15 years ago. But on the other hand, and throughout your talk tonight, the concept that someone, country is in a position of such authority such as yourself, that has such modesty about the means with which it's working in architecture, is something that I think several generations of architects in this country, and particularly mine and the younger ones, have just not learned. That the architectural artifact is this sort of payload object, which first of all has little to do with the city, or nearly nothing. I mean, I think what we're trying to do, as you know, here, and that's why you supported it, is trying to diffuse that relationship and sort of re-educate the mind. But that's something that I think is even, it's not more problematic, it's equally problematic. That the profession which is there to serve or service sort of a political aspiration just doesn't have the ability.
How many of you are architects in this room? It seems to me that the architect, as I said earlier, that if the issues we look at which allow us to grow. If you look at the Bauhaus, it was a dynamite what they produced. And yet in terms of talent, I would think the Germans today are as talented, or the Europeans, as they were 185 years ago. Because God distributes talent like rainfall or something. But the issues were different. The issues today are myopic. People don't have a chance to go. Look at the questions that they ask themselves in the Bauhaus. What is furniture? What is dance? What is music? What is building? What is society? Now, why has that gone out of the world? And in a way, in a funny way, in the third world it exists, because the issues are so epic. And I thought what was very good about what you're trying to do here is that you're asking big questions, and the students are asking big questions for themselves. And one of the questions, of course, is about urbanization, which gets you into housing. Now, if you look at them, yesterday we were discussing with them, the day before on the car, if you look back to the 20s of the last century, the modern movement was actually the energy, the engine driving it was housing. It was, whether it's called Musée or Nice or anyone you want to go to. It reached the point now where the best talents are producing something quite different. Housing is no longer taught in architecture in schools, really, in America, at least, I don't know about here. And it's not practiced. I mean, people, it's the one-off building, it's the airport, it's the museum. And these are basically culture-free and almost value-free buildings. I'm not criticizing them, but it's sad that our profession has been now made small by the roles which our clients ask us to do now. The second thing we lose from that is that any architect is working on several different projects at the same time, at different scales. It's quite different from making a team of filmmakers. I'm sure whoever it is, Spielberg works on one film, if it's one film, then we do about five or six. Some have stopped and some may start and some are going through street. Now, you're designing a little house, but some ideas about that house you can suddenly use at the level of a whole township or at the level of an airport and vice versa. So that cross-fertilization is tremendously important. If all I did was work on one kind of building, I would actually become stultified. I was reading the other day that someone told me that Bill Gates, of course, is so rich, he built a house. And what he did, he chose an architect, and he didn't choose someone like Frank Gehry, he chose some small firm, a very good firm, and said, I want to buy your time for the next 25 years. You can't take any other commission but my house. Now, and he was thrilled, I suppose. But that was a way of committing suicide as architects, because there would be no more other income. So the thing about doing housing isn't just that you do good housing or bad housing, but it's going to increase the dimension of the issues you look at. And that's going to help you. And that's why Corbusier's work, Corbusier's work was always elitist, was always, you know, an esteem. But it had this other dimension, because you have to look at it. You have to then say the sun rises and the sun sets, and that 24-hour cycle is worth going anything you make. That comes out of thinking about something very primordial and basic about life. Not just the way through material, even on a staircase. Would Brian like to say a few words about transport?
Yeah, hello. What's changed dramatically in India? What has changed in your mind dramatically in India over the 5 years?
What has changed?
It's just in terms of as a result of the communication boom and the satellite boom and the internet boom. And how do you see that actually, or how do you see being able to use that to achieve our goals? As architects in cities in India.
Right, I'm the wrong person to ask that to show. I think in our own office, of course, we have, living in Bombay, we have much better access to a whole lot of things because of the internet. I think in terms of just the technology of the computers, etc., it's helped us a lot in working drawing. Because I have a small office, it's only about 12 or 15 people.
You mean more at the level of society and design?
Yeah. What I meant is, okay, media, actually, how things, like, for instance, what's happening in, is that Naidu who's doing really well or something?
Hyderabad, in Hyderabad.
In Hyderabad, yeah. And, I mean, he's achieving certain fluency and fluidity and efficiency in the state system. And obviously, it is because of his own drive. But I don't know, there must be a way of utilizing, but he's using this technology, the new technology, to achieve what he wants to achieve. Mm. How, as an advisor, or could we sort of use that as well.
I would like to really bring the end of this wonderful hour and a half to a close, only because we can remember some of the key messages on that. Charles has given us tonight, I think the word, did you say wabi shabi? Is that what you call it? I sort of feel that that's the word I have to use about you tonight, about the sort of insight and maturity. But I really do think that the messages for all of us at this organization, the Pacific Program,